Even as librarians rewrite the definition of what makes for a library in the 21st century, they are also redrafting their job descriptions. Along with the academic degrees and professional training, the librarians in 2015 should know how to party. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. New Jersey City University librarian J.P. Porcaro wants to be president of the American Library Association, even though he already holds the title to Party King of Librarianship. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, joins me on the line to explain what Porcaro's election later this year could mean to the ALA and for American popular culture. And welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, you know, as we indicated just recently, the presidential race for 2016 is already heating up and setting to be quite the contest. And we're not talking about for the White House, but for the presidency of the ALA. And in this coming Monday's issue, you have a closer look at what should be a fascinating race. So tell us about it.
Yeah, it's been a really fun piece for me to do, I have to say. And I spoke to a lot of people at the recent ALA midwinter meeting in Chicago about the ALA presidential race. Now, I don't want listeners to fall out of their chairs here, but believe me, this year's election for president in the American Library Association is actually worth paying attention to. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, presidential politics in the ALA hasn't exactly engaged rank-and-file librarians in recent years, and most of its modern history, as a matter of fact. You know, the candidates are almost always the senior experienced librarians. Some of them are retired or approaching retirement and looking to serve the profession by being president. But, you know, most of the job description is like they're talking heads. Occasionally they talk to the media, they go on the Today Show. There's some administrative duties, some ribbon cutting, occasional tone setting for the profession, and it only takes about 5,000 votes to win the gig. And that's in an organization with over 51,000 eligible voters. In fact, 8 out of 10 ALA members don't even cast a ballot for ALA president, despite the fact that you can do it easily online. So I think that shows you what the level of involvement in ALA politics is. But in recent years, I will say, pretty much since the whole ebook flap began around 2011, things have begun to change with the ALA presidency. The current occupant of that office is Courtney Young, and she is, her name notwithstanding, a young librarian. She's the first millennial to actually win that job, and just the fifth African American to hold that post in 124 years of continuous elections. So she kind of broke the mold with her election. And it turns out that the odds-on favorite to win for 2016 ALA president, the voting for which begins this year on March 24th, is another millennial, this hip young guy named J.P. Porcaro, whose campaign hashtags include Party Hard and Make It Happen. Now, to put it mildly, JP, who I met with in Chicago, doesn't fit the mold of ALA presidents. In fact, he obliterates the mold. In 2013, FlavorWire named him one of the coolest librarians alive. And you may recall seeing Porcaro decked out in these really cool yellow-framed specs and a crooked cap among the tattooed librarians in Jordan Teicher's 2014 Slate photo essay, This is What a Librarian Looks Like. Porcaro, as you mentioned, also lists professional partier among his past positions. And in his 2012 Library Journal Mover and Shaker profile, he proudly proclaimed to be the party king of librarianship. You know, but don't let this playfulness fool you. Porcaro is the head of acquisitions at the Guarini Library in New Jersey City University, and he is a serious librarian and a natural leader. And while, you know, he may cut across the grain of traditional librarianship, at least as we have come to know it, make no mistake, his campaign for the ALA presidency is proving to be a gift for the profession. Whether or not he wins, he is effectively rallying a generation of young librarians not only to fight for the future of libraries and librarianship, but also to participate more in the ALA. And in an organization that's seen its membership slide precipitously over the last decade, it's down from a high of 66,000 members in 2005 to 55,000 today. It's bleeding on average about 1,000 members a year. It's a big deal. Now, at ALA midwinter, I was really stunned because I was, you know, expecting to do a little bit on the ALA presidency there, but I was stunned by how many people are really excited to vote, and especially to vote for JP this year. And his use of social media is a blueprint, not only on how to engage ALA members, but how to run a campaign for ALA president in the coming years. Now, he's not a lock to win the election for sure. I think his advantage on social media like makes him a favorite, but there are three other strong candidates running for the job this year, including Julie Todaro, who's the Dean of Libraries at Austin Community College and an excellent speaker and author and well-known in the profession. Joe Janes, who's Associate Professor at the University of Washington iSchool. Same for him. He's a very well-known speaker, very involved in the library community, and also a great author. And there's Jamie LaRue, the former director of the Douglas County, Colorado Libraries, who's now a consultant. And the last time we talked about the ALA presidency, we talked about LaRue, because while he's also an experienced librarian, he too is something of a maverick. At Douglas County, you'll recall, LaRue was the one that set up his own ebook lending service, and he has been an unflinching critic of the major publishers and vendors restricting access to ebooks. And part of his platform is this desire to shift libraries from what he says are gatekeepers to gardeners. That is, to move them from being mostly these passive purchasers of content to actually enabling content creation through things like self-publishing and makerspaces among their constituents. Now, how that's going to work out this year, no one knows at this point. But we can say that interest in the election is high. And expectations are that this year's election, with four strong candidates, is going to have the highest turnout in decades. And whoever wins, I think it's fair to say that the ALA is likely a winner too. Because for one, interest in the job, a job that's become much more serious in recent years, is going to make a difference in participation. And especially when it comes to the young people who are being brought in. You know, the more voices you can bring into ALA, the better it's going to be for libraries.
Well, and indeed, I think better for our country as well. And indeed, some news from Washington that actually sounds like an upbeat announcement. We've got word that net neutrality will become official. And we learned earlier this week that the Republicans decided not to block the new proposed rules on net neutrality. This is something ALA was really keen to see happen, and it's a big win for them.
Absolutely. And I think this is an excellent example of the kinds of things that libraries are really fighting for now, and that you may well see the ALA president, you know, talking in front of Congress on issues like this in the future. The ALA has been very active in fighting for net neutrality and for an open internet, right alongside the tech companies and the public watchdog groups. And as I've said before, I think on this program many times, you know, the ALA Washington office, that's their sort of lobbying operation in D.C. on behalf of libraries, really has got some game. They are a very, very effective outfit. And so the fact that the news this week that net neutrality was actually approved was a huge win for them, an absolutely huge deal. For those of us who are, you know, may not be quite up to speed on what net neutrality is, I don't think that's many of our listeners, but, you know, it basically boils down to, you know, the major ISPs, that is mainly the Time Warners and the Comcast of the world, you know, wanted to be able to offer faster internet for pay. You know, basically they wanted to be able to sell higher delivery speeds to companies that could pay for it. But, you know, the critics argue that, you know, this would essentially allow them to slow down internet delivery for others. For example, Amazon Prime or Netflix. You know, if you're Comcast and you have your own pay-per-view service and your own internet lines, you know, you own the internet structures, you'd be able to charge competitors like Netflix much, much higher sums to be able to deliver their product to consumers. So that was a real worry. You know, the internet providers, on the other hand, like Comcast, had argued that now they have no incentive to really invest in creating a faster internet and putting more money into the internet infrastructure, which I find laughable. You're an internet company and you don't have an incentive to invest in your internet service. It makes no sense to me. But suffice it to say, this is a big win on a big issue for libraries. But the battle is clearly far from over. You know there's going to be a court challenge to this at some point, and we'll look for the amicus brief from ALA when that happens.
All right. Well, the library-publisher relationship is clearly a key one, and we've got some news on that front, actually from two separate places. Barnes & Noble had a surprise announcement this week, and Baker & Taylor late last week announced it was selling off two parts of its own business. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, and Monday's issue we'll have more on Baker & Taylor, but yeah, we'll start off with Barnes & Noble because it was a bit of a surprise move. B&N announced this week that it's going to separate its college business from its retail trade stores and the Nook business. Now, the retailer has been considering splitting up the company for about a year. We've talked about those plans on this show. We've speculated about those plans on a number of occasions. But it was generally thought that the trade segment would be separated from the college and the Nook business. Remember, the college and the Nook business are actually housed together in the Nook Media unit. You know, know, the second option was that BNN would try to spin off or sell its money-losing digital business, the Nook business, entirely. Instead, BNN this week said that it's going to keep the trade stores together with the Nook business and spin off the college business into a separately publicly traded company. It says, hopefully, by the end of August. Now, I have a lot of thoughts on this and a lot of questions, and I think there's plenty that I could say at this point, but I'm going to wait because, you know, August is a long way off. Sorry to say that to those of you in Boston, August is a long way off. And with Barnes & Noble, you just never know what's going to happen. So whatever speculation I might have now might be completely moot by the time this actually happens in August.
Well, we'll let you hold that thought, and I'm sure you'll update us as later news comes in. But back to Baker & Taylor for a moment. So their announcement was to divest themselves of two key pieces of their business.
Yeah, and I also have questions about this too. But in Monday's issue, we have a story and an exclusive interview with Baker & Taylor officials on their decision to sell its publishing and warehouse groups to ReaderLink and its really outstanding academic library business, Yankee Book Peddler, known as YBP, to EBSCO. You know, you may recall that B&T bought the two businesses at different points over the last 16 years. It acquired the publishing warehouse unit in 2007 from AMS after that company filed for bankruptcy. And it picked up YBP back in 1999. And Baker & Taylor officials said that both divisions had actually grown nicely and they were actually doing well, but they plan to use the funds from those sales to boost their investments in the public library market, where it is by far the biggest player, and in its traditional and definitely a traditional area of strength, public libraries, and also into the K-12 classroom library space. I think the move indicates that BNT probably wants to speed up the adoption of digital in the school market and senses an opportunity to help do that. You know, the school market has been much slower to adopt ebooks and other digital options than the public library business. But B&T says it's also going to use some of the funds to pay down some debt. And that's going to be something to pay attention to as well. We'll see how that sets up B&T to move into other spaces perhaps in the future. So we'll be paying attention to how this all plays out. And in Monday's issue, we'll have an article about what the move might mean. And it's eye-opening to say the least, the two moves by two big industry players. And I think it starts us off for a year that we're going to see a lot of transactions like this in the publishing library space.
Well, and when they happen, we'll turn to Andrew Albanese, senior writer at Publishers Weekly, for news on all of that. Andrew Albanese, thanks so much for joining us on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You could follow us on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.